Chapter 21. Have you ever noticed how on a trip, even a very long one, it is often the first week or so that stands out most clearly in your memory? Perhaps it is the enhanced perception that voyages bring, or perhaps it is an effect of orientation response on the senses, or perhaps it is simply that even the charm of newness soon wears off. But it has been my experience that the first days in a new place or seeing new people often set the tone for the rest of the trip, or in this case, the rest of my life. We spent the first day of our magnificent adventure sleeping. The child was exhausted and, I had to admit, after waking from 16 hours of uninterrupted sleep, so was I. I can't vouch for what A. Bedick did during this first somnambulant day of the voyage. At that point, I had not learned that androids do sleep, but require only a fraction of the time we humans spend comatose. But he had set his small backpack of possessions in the engine room, rigging a hammock to sleep in, and he spent much of his time down there. I had planned to give the girl the master bedroom at the apex of the ship. She had showered there in the adjoining bathroom cubby that first morning, but she staked out one of the sleep couches on the fugue deck, and that soon became her space. I enjoyed the size and softness of the large bed in the center of the circular top room, and after a while, even overcame my agoraphobia and allowed the hull to go translucent to watch the fractal light show in Hawking space outside. I never kept the hull transparent for long, however, for the pulsing geometries continued to disturb me in ways I could not describe. The library level and the hollow pit level were, by unspoken agreement, common ground. The kitchen, A. Bedick called it the galley, was set into the wall on the hollow pit level, and we usually ate at the low table in the hollow pit or occasionally carried the food up to the round table near the navigation cubby. I admit that immediately after awakening and having breakfast, ship time said that it was afternoon on Hyperion, but why abide by Hyperion time when I might never see that world again? I headed for the library. The books were ancient, all published during the time of the hegemony or earlier, and I was surprised to find a copy of an epic poem by Martin Silenus, The Dying Earth, as well as tomes by a dozen classical authors whom I had read as a boy, and often reread during my long days and nights at the Fen cabin or while working on the river. A. Bedick joined me that first day as I browsed and pulled a small green volume from the shelves. "This might be of interest," he said. The title was A Traveler's Guide to the World Web, with special sections on the Grand Concourse and River Tethys. "It might be of great interest," I said, opening the book with shaking fingers. The shaking, I believe, came from the reality that we were going there, actually traveling to the former web worlds. "These books are doubly interesting as artifacts," said the android, "since they came from an age when all information was instantly available to anyone." I nodded. As a child, listening to Grandam's tales of the old days, I had tried to imagine a world where everyone wore implants and could access the datasphere whenever they wanted. Of course, even then, Hyperion had no datasphere and had never been part of the web. But for most of the billions of members of the hegemony, life must have been like an endless stim sim of visual, auditory, and printed information. No wonder a majority of humans had never learned to read during the old days. Literacy had been one of the first goals of the Church and its Pax administrators after interstellar society was stitched together long after the fall. That day, standing in the carpeted ship's library, the polished teak and cherrywood walls gleaming in the light, I remember taking half a dozen books from the shelves and carrying them to the table to read. Ania raided the library that afternoon as well, immediately pulling The Dying Earth from the shelves. "There were no copies in Jacktown, and Uncle Martin refused to let me read it when I visited him," she said. "He did say that it was the only thing he'd ever written, other than the cantos that he hadn't finished, that was worth reading." "What's it about?" I asked, not looking up from the Delmore Deland novel I was skimming. Both the girl and I were munching on apples as we read and talked. abetic had gone back down the spiral stairs. "The last days of old Earth," said Anea. "It's really about Martin's pampered childhood on his family's big estate on the North American Preserve." I set my book down. "What do you think happened to old Earth?" The girl stopped munching. "In my day, everyone thought that the big mistake of Aught-8 Black Hole had eaten it, that it was gone, kaput." I chewed and nodded. "Most people still believe that, but the old poets Kantos insist that the Techno Corps stole old Earth and sent it somewhere." "The Hercules Cluster or the Magellanic Clouds," said the girl and took another bite of apple. "My mother discovered that when she and my father were investigating his murder." I leaned forward. "Do you mind talking about your father?" Anea smiled slightly. "No, why should I? I suppose I'm somewhat of a half-breed, the child of a Lusian woman and a clone cybrid male, but that's never bothered me."
"You don't look very Lusian," I said. "Residents of that high-G world were invariably short and very strong. Most were pale of skin and dark-haired. This child was small, but of a height normal to 1G worlds. Her brown hair was streaked with blonde, and she was slender. Only her luminous brown eyes reminded me of the Kantos' description of Braun Lamia." Anea laughed. It was a pleasant sound.
"I take after my dad," she said. "John Keats was short, blonde, and skinny."
I hesitated a moment before saying, "You said that you spoke to your father." Anea glanced at me from the corners of her eyes.
"Yes, and you know that the Corps killed his body before I was born. But did you also know that my mother carried his persona for months in a shrone loop embedded behind her ear?"
I nodded. "It was in the Kantos." The girl shrugged.
"I remember talking to him."
"But you weren't..."
"Born," said Anea. "Right. What kind of conversation could a poet's persona have with a fetus? But we talked. His persona was still connected to the Techno Corps. He showed me... Well, it's complicated, Rawl, believe me."
"I believe you," I said. I looked around the library.
"Did you know that the Kantos say that when your father's persona left the Shrone Loop, that it resided in this ship's AI for a while?"
"Yeah," said Anea.
She grinned.
"Yesterday, before I went to sleep, I spent an hour or so talking to the ship. My dad was here all right. The persona coexisted with the ship's mind when the consul flew back to check out what had happened to the web after the fall. But he's not here now, and the ship can't remember much about his residence here. And it doesn't remember anything about what happened to him, whether he left after the consul died or what. So I don't know if he still exists."
"Well," I said, trying to choose diplomatic words. "The Corps doesn't exist any longer, so I don't quite see how a cybrid persona could either."
"Who says the Corps doesn't exist?"
I admit that I was shocked by that statement. The last act of Mayna Gladstone and the Hegemony was to destroy the Farcaster links, the Datasphere, the Fat Line, and the entire dimension that the Corps existed in, I said at last. "Even the Kantos agrees with that fact." The child was still smiling.
"Oh, they blew the space-based Farcasters to bits, and the others quit working all right. And the Dataspheres were gone in my time, too. But who says the Corps is dead? That's like saying that you swept away a couple of spider webs, so the spider has to be dead."
I admit that I looked over my shoulder. "So you think the Techno Corps still exists? That those AIs are still plotting against us?"
"I don't know about the plotting," said Anea. "But I know that the Corps exists."
"How?" She held up a small finger.
"First of all, my father's cybrid persona still existed after the fall, right? The basis for that persona was a Corps AI they had fashioned. That shows that the Corps was still... somewhere."
I thought about that. As I mentioned earlier, cybrids, like androids, were essentially a mythical species to me. We might as well have been discussing the physical characteristics of leprechauns.
"Secondly," she said, lifting a second finger to join the first, "I've communicated with the Corps."
I blinked at that statement.
before you were born? I said.
Yes, said Aeneia. And when I lived with Mother in Jacktown, and after Mother died.
She lifted her books and stood.
And this morning?
I could only stare.
I'm hungry, Rawl,
she said from the head of the stairs.
Want to go down and see what this old ship's galley can womp up for lunch?
We soon settled into a schedule on the ship, adopting Hyperion's day and night schedules roughly as waking and sleeping times. I began to see why the old hegemony habit of keeping the 24-hour old Earth system as standard had been so important in the web days. I'd read somewhere that almost 90% of the Earth-like or terraformed worlds of the web had held days that fell within 3 hours of the old Earth standard day. Aeneia still liked to extend the balcony and play the Steinway out under the Hawking space sky, and I would sometimes stay out there and listen for a few minutes, but I preferred the sense of being surrounded that the interior of the ship gave me. None of us complained about the effects of the C-plus environment, although we felt it. The occasional lurching of emotion and balance, a constant sense that someone was watching us, and very strange dreams. My own dreams awakened me, with the pounding heart, dry mouth, and sweat-soaked sheets that only the worst nightmares could cause. But I never remembered the dreams. I wanted to ask the others about their dreams, but A. Bedick never mentioned his. I did not know if androids could dream. And although Aeneia acknowledged the strangeness of her dreams and said that she did remember them, she never discussed them. On the second day, while we were sitting in the library, Aeneia suggested that we experience space travel. When I asked her how we could experience it more than we were, I had the Hawking fractals in mind when I said that, she only laughed and asked the ship to cancel the internal containment field. Immediately, we were weightless. As a boy, I had dreamed of zero-G. Swimming in the salty South Sea as a young soldier, I had closed my eyes, floated effortlessly, and wondered if this was what space travel in the olden days had been like. I can tell you, it is not. Zero-G, especially sudden zero-G, such as the ship granted upon Aeneia's request, is terrifying. It is, quite simply, falling. Or so it first seems. I gripped the chair, but the chair was also falling. It was precisely as if we had been sitting in one of the huge bridle-range cable cars for the past 2 days, when suddenly the cable broke. My middle ear protested, trying to find a horizon line that was honest. None was. A. Bedick kicked up from wherever he had been below and said calmly, "Is there a problem?"
"No," laughed Aeneia. "We're just going to experience space for a while."
A. Bedick nodded and then pulled himself head first down the stairway pit to get back to whatever he was working on. Aeneia followed him to the stairwell, kicking over to the central opening.
"See," she said, "this stairwell becomes a central drop shaft when the ship is in zero G, just like in the old spin ships."
"Isn't this dangerous?" I asked, switching my grip from the back of a chair to a bookshelf. For the first time I noticed the elastic cords that held the books in place. Everything else that was not attached, the book I had set on the table, the chairs around the table, a sweater I'd left thrown over the back of another chair, pieces of the orange I had been eating, was floating.
"Not dangerous," said Aeneia. "Messy. Next time we get everything shipshape before we cancel the internal field."
"But isn't the field important?" Aeneia was floating upside down from my perspective. My inner ear liked this even less than the rest of the experience.
"The field keeps us from being squashed and thrown around when we're moving in normal space," she said,
pulling herself to the center of the 20-meter drop by grabbing the stairway railing.
"But we can't speed up or slow down in C-plus space, so here goes."
She grabbed a handhold along the rod that ran the length of the ship in the center of what had been the open stairwell and catapulted herself out of sight, head first. "Jesus," I whispered, pushed away from the bookcase, bouncing off the opposite bulkhead, and followed her down the central drop shaft. For the next hour, we played in zero G, 0G tag, 0G hide and seek, finding that one could hide in the oddest places when gravity was not a restraint. 0G soccer using one of the plastic space helmets from a locker on the storage corridor deck. And even 0G wrestling, which was harder than I would have imagined. My first attempt to grab the child sent both of us tumbling and crashing through the length, breadth, and height of fugue deck. In the end, exhausted and sweaty, the perspiration hung in the air until one moved, or a trickle of air from the ventilators moved it, I discovered. And Nia ordered the balcony opened again. I shouted in fear when she did so, but the ship quietly reminded me that the exterior field was quite intact, and we floated out above the bolted-down Steinway, floated to the railing and beyond, into that no-man's land between the ship and the field, floated 10 meters out and looked back at the ship itself, surrounded by exploding fractals, glowing in the cold fireworks glory of it, as Hawking space folded and contracted around us several billion times a second. Finally, we kicked and swam our way back in, a difficult and awkward feat I discovered when there was nothing to push against, warned A. Betic over the intercom to find a floor, and brought back the 1G internal field. Both the child and I giggled as sweaters, sandwiches, chairs, books, and several spheres of water from a glass that had been left out came crashing down to the carpet. It was that same day, night rather, for the ship had dimmed the lights for sleep period, that I padded down the spiral stairs to the hollow pit level to fix a midnight snack and heard soft sounds through the opening to the fugue deck below. "Ania?" I said, speaking softly. There was no answer. I went to the head of the stairs, looking at the dark drop in the center of the stairwell and smiling as I remembered our midair antics there a few hours before. "Ania?" There still came no answer, but the soft sounds continued. Wishing I had a flashlight, I padded down the metal stairs in my sock feet. There was a soft glow from the fugue sleep monitors above the couches tucked in their cubbies. The soft sound was coming from Ania's cubby. She had her back to me. The blanket was pulled to her shoulders, but I could see the collar of the consul's old shirt that she had appropriated for use as a nightshirt. I walked over, my sock feet making no noise on the soft floor, and knelt by the couch. "Ania." The girl was crying, obviously trying to muffle her sobs. I touched her shoulder and she finally turned. Even in the dim instrument glow, I could see that she had been weeping for some time. Her eyes were red and puffy, her cheeks streaked with tears. "What's wrong, kiddo?" I whispered. We were two decks above where A. Betic slept in his hammock in the engine room, but the stairwell was open. For a moment, Ania did not respond, but eventually the sobs slowed, then stopped. "I'm sorry," she said at last. "It's all right. Tell me what's wrong." "Give me a tissue and I will," said the girl. I rummaged in the pockets of the old robe the consul had left. I had no tissue, but I had been using a napkin with the cake I'd been eating upstairs. I handed her the linen.
"Thanks."
She blew her nose.
"I'm glad we're not still in 0G, she said through the cloth. "There'd be snot floating everywhere."
I smiled and squeezed her shoulder. "What's wrong, Ania?" She made a soft noise that I realized was an attempt at a laugh.
"Everything," she said. "Everything's wrong. I'm scared. Everything I know about the future scares the shit out of me. I don't know how we're going to get past the PAX guys that I know will be waiting for us in a few days. I'm homesick. I can never go back, and everybody I knew except Martin is gone forever. Mostly, though, I guess I just miss my mother."
I squeezed her shoulder. Braun Lamia, her mother, was the stuff of legend, a woman who had lived and died 2.5 long centuries ago. A few of her bones had already turned to dust wherever they were buried. For this child, her mother's death was only 2 weeks in the past. "I'm sorry," I whispered, and squeezed her shoulder again,
feeling the texture of the consul's old shirt. It'll be all right. Ania nodded and took my hand. Hers were still moist. I noticed how tiny her palm and fingers were against my huge paw. "Want to come up to the galley and have some chalma root cake and milk with me?" I whispered. "It's good." She shook her head.
"I think I'll sleep now. Thanks, Rol."
She squeezed my hand again before relinquishing it, and in that second I realized the great truth. The one who teaches, the new Messiah, whatever Braun Lamia's daughter would turn out to be, she was also a child, one who giggled in zero-gravity antics and who wept in the night. I went softly up the stairs, stopping to look back at her before my head rose above the level of the next deck. She was huddled under her blanket, her face turned away again, her hair catching only a bit of the console glow from above her cubby. "Good night, Ania," I whispered, knowing that she would not hear me. "It will be all right."